Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on the oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. City of Murphy versus City of Parker from Collin County. Benchmark Bank versus Frank and Marion Crowder from Dallas County. Wichita County versus Alan Hart and Ernie Williams from Travis County. And Cities for Fair Utility Rates in the State of Texas versus the Public Utility Commission of Texas and Houston Lighting and Power Company from Travis County. In each of these matters, the court allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. Petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal. If you desire to have a copy of the tape of this argument, you may make application and pay a small fee to the clerk of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and finish these arguments before our lunch break. We are ready to hear from petitioner in the City of Murphy versus City of Parker.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Brown will present arguments for the petitioners. Petitioners to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Brown of the Dallas Law Firm of Bilhelm and Cogan Knox, and I'm here on behalf of the petitioner of the City of Murphy, Texas. The facts in this case are disputed. I assume the court is familiar with them. Unless the court requests otherwise, I will not spend extensive time on those facts. I move to state that back in 1989, the City of Parker, the respondent, annexed some territory. Approximately 14 acres of that territory was contained within the City of Murphy's extraterritorial jurisdiction, which I'll refer to shorthand as ETJ. The trial court and the Court of Appeals upheld a summary judgment granted on behalf of the City of Parker under the sole basis that Section 43.901 of the Texas Local Government Code acted as a 2-year statute of limitations that would prohibit the City of Murphy from bringing its declaratory judgment action to try to set aside that annexation. I think this is a case of first impression, and it's a case of statutory construction this court must undertake today. In order to do that, I believe it's important to go back historically to look at not only the current law, but the predecessor law. And that takes us back to 1949. The source law for the current section that we're looking at is Article 974C-4, and a copy of that is set out in our brief. And that basically was a validating act. It validated annexations of territory that were annexed with the consent of a majority of the inhabitants of the annexed territory. That's set out in Section 1 of that article. Section 2 of that article provided a 2-year presumed consent provision that says that consent to that annexation and the inclusion of such territory in the city shall be conclusively presumed if a lawsuit is not brought within 2 years.
Your contention is that that does not apply to a municipality like your client?
That's correct.
Who does it apply to?
It applies to those individuals in adjoining property who would have to consent to the annexation. You have to look at the article in its entirety to determine to whom the consent provision is referring. Section 1 talks about ratification of annexations with the consent of a majority of the inhabitants of annexed territory.
Why would the legislature not bar suits by municipalities, let them bring them, I guess, in perpetuity, but would bar suits brought by citizens?
Well, there has historically been a public policy distinction between statute of limitations as applied to individuals and typical corporations and municipal corporations. The Texas Civil Practice Remedies Code in Chapter 16, which sets out our general statute of limitations, has a section that expressly prohibits most statute of limitations as applying to cities. And the public policy for that is set out in the cases is that the citizens should not be penalized because of the neglect of the governing body, the negligence of the governing body, or even perhaps the willful disregard of the governing body, because it's fundamentally unfair, at least from a public policy viewpoint, to allow a city council by its inaction to allow the rights of the citizens to be barred by such a statute of limitations.
And because of that policy that you argue in favor of, limitations never runs. And no matter what sort of investment the annexing municipality makes in terms of improvements, fire protection, sewage, whatever, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years later, suit can be brought to set aside that annexation.
Well, under traditional limitations, I would say no. Now, conceivably, an argument could perhaps be made in a 40, 50-year period for some kind of latches or estoppel, but as a general rule, those doctrines also do not apply to governmental entities, basically for the same public policy reasons.
So there would be no limitation?
Well, I don't want to mislead the court. There are certain statute of limitations that do apply to cities. The Civil Practice and Remedies Code sets out those that cities are exempt from and those to which the that do apply. For example, 16.005 is a 2-year statute of limitations for road closings. Cities have to abide by that. 16.008, 10-year statute for architects and engineers. 10-year statute for those people repairing real property. 10-year statute to bring a cause of action against surveyors.
But in this case, if this is not a limitation period, there wouldn't be one.
That is correct. This would fall within the category of those types of calls of action where the legislature has seen fit to allow a city never to be barred by limitation.
Your argument that cities are exempt from limitation statutes because their inhabitants ought not to be punished as a result of the inattention of city officials cuts both ways, though, doesn't it? In this case, the inhabitants of one of these two cities are going to be adversely affected by the result of this case.
Well, that is potentially true, and that's potentially true in any case where someone asserts that an estoppel should not apply against the city.
So how does that policy counsel against limitations as opposed to in favor of it? Looks to me like it cuts both ways.
Well, I don't believe it does, Judge, because I think that the fact that there's two cities involved or the fact that there are some perhaps some equities on the other side does not, in my opinion, change that basic rule, because once again, the public policy should be the city who would be bringing a lawsuit. Its citizens should not be made to suffer because those in power either did not bring a lawsuit in time, or as in this case, were just not aware that an action had been taken in violation of extraterritorial jurisdiction and brought the lawsuit in time. So while there are public policy arguments, I believe, that can be made in the manner which you're suggesting, the paramount public policy that I believe that these cases tend to address is that the citizens in a fundamental area, such as extraterritorial jurisdiction, should not have that territory and the rights associated with the territory taken away from them simply because 2 years have passed.
But don't constituents of any representative body, whether it's city council or anybody else, suffer, to use your phrase, because of the acts of their representatives on a regular basis, and the recourse is to toss them out the next election?
Well, I agree. The recourse is at the ballot box. The problem is, if you construe Section 43.901 as a 2-year statute of limitations, that does not necessarily give a citizen's time to replace the governing body in its totality to undo the situation. You take a hypothetical, assume you had a city council that knew that another city had come in and taken part of its ETJ, but that city council says, well, we're not going to sue. We're just going to, I don't care what the people want, we're not going to sue for either neglect or fraud, corruption, whatever the parade of horribles you want to put out there. The people would be forever barred from correcting that error under the trial court and the court of appeals construction of Section 43.901, because they viewed that as a 2-year statute of limitations. These other statute of limitations that the court, that the legislature has held applies to cities. Such as I mentioned, the 10-year statute of limitations for architects, 15 years for product liability. These are much longer statutes of limitations. And quite frankly, these are also in areas that are not as fundamentally governmental. We're talking about suing an architect or an engineer. You're not talking about actions that comprise the body of a city, the boundaries of a city, and the potential boundaries of a city.
If a city does build a substantial infrastructure in wrongly annexed territory, what happens?
That would be something that would have to be resolved after the annexation is voided. I don't think the law has addressed
that. How is it resolved? How would it be resolved?
Once there's been a legal determination, for example, in this case, assuming that this court reverses the Court of Appeals and the trial court, and the trial court sees fit then to declare the annexation void, this territory would then once again become part of the county and be within Murphy's ETJ. At that point, then Murphy would have the option to annex that territory. Or quite frankly, just to sit down at the table with the other municipality to work out some compromise. But while those are the realities that would fall after the court's decision, with all due respect, I believe that the decision today should be limited to what did the legislature intend when it passed that ordinance. And I don't believe that the equitable weighing of the relative benefits or burdens in this particular situation should sway the court, because you're going to make a decision of an application statewide to all cities.
I'm trying to decide what it means, though. It is useful to know if it makes sense. And it doesn't seem to me to make much sense for the one city to have to either choose to maintain the infrastructure or abandon it without it having it in its tax base. You say they'll negotiate, but if they can't negotiate, that's going to be the situation.
Well, that is something that has to be looked at, but I would submit that you look at other statutes, take the validating acts that the legislature passes every 2 years, and every instance they have validated practically everything under the sun with the exception of constitutional infirmities and annexations of property into another city's ETJ without compliance with the Municipal Annexation Act. So there could be a number of situations that are similar to this that could have been validated but have not been validated. The legislature historically...
Do you know of any?
No, I don't know any factual situations where that has occurred.
But isn't your argument that the Validating Act did not validate this predicated on your statement that the consent of the persons does not cover municipalities?
That is correct.
That is the basis of your argument, isn't it?
The basis of the argument is that in 1949, when the prior article was passed, it's important to remember there was no such thing as extraterritorial jurisdiction. That concept did not come about until the Municipal Annexation Act was passed in 1963. So back in 1949, there was no consent that a city could give for annexation. You did not need consent of another city to annex, because you could quite frankly annex all the way up to another city's property line. There was no extraterritorial jurisdiction. So in 1949, I don't believe you can cogently argue that in 1949 the legislature intended the consent provisions to apply to cities for two reasons. One, there was nothing for a city to consent to in 1949, and number two, the only persons to which the consent provisions appear to be referring to are the consent of inhabitants in other areas that would consent to an annexation. So then when you jump forward in time to the codification through the local government code in 1987, which is supposed to be a completely non-substantive change in the law, you quite frankly have to look to the old law and say, would the old law have applied to a city? If it would not have applied to a city to bar this lawsuit, then you really cannot say the new law bars the lawsuit against the city. Because if that is the case, then that means the Texas Legislative Council has improperly broadened the scope of that law through its codification. I don't deny the legislature has the power to do that. But according to the Code Construction Act and the preamble of the Texas Local Government Code, it was supposed to have been a non-substantive change. And that's basically the gist of the argument.
But the logic of your argument is, if it's since cities before 1949 didn't have ETJs, they could not have objected to this annexation, correct?
That's correct.
So if, to follow the reasoning of your logic, since they couldn't object to then, and this codification wasn't supposed to change the law, then Murphy shouldn't be able to object now.
Well, it's not so much being able to object, it's being able to consent. There was no, in 1949, had this annexation taken place, there would be nothing wrong with it because Murphy would not have had an extraterritorial jurisdiction.
Now,
there's nothing to consent to.
But after 49, then Murphy obtains this right, as citizens did, of consenting to this ETJ.
They can.
And so in the codification, it simply recognizes that Murphy could lose its consent just like other citizens could lose its consent.
Well, the problem there is we're talking about consent to two different items. Murphy can consent to give up part of its ETJ. That's not the same thing as consenting to an annexation. There really is no requirement that a city consent to another city's annexation. You can consent to give up part of your ETJ, which then brings us to another fundamental problem. Even then, once one city gives up part of its ETJ, the other city does not necessarily have the right to come in and annex that territory unless the other city's ETJ expands to fill that void, that area that's been relinquished. And the local government code places severe restrictions on that, too. The city can only annex property that it owns or that's within its ETJ, and its ETJ is determined by its population. These two limitations were expressly pointed out by this court in its recent Laidlaw decision.
Let me just ask you quickly about what would you have us do with the government code, which says that the term person includes governmental subdivisions or agencies?
Well, by definition, it says that the Code Construction Act says that definition of person shall apply unless the context suggests otherwise or demands otherwise. So it's not a conclusive definition, and it is our contention in this case exactly that the context, in light of public policy, in light of prior law, that the context of person should not be deemed to include municipality, even though the definition on its face would include that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Rapier will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning. Introduced, John Rapier from Allen, Texas, city attorney for Parker, Texas. Parker would like to address three issues relating to the case before you this morning. And those issues are one we've already covered to some extent this morning, as well briefed and covered by the Court of Appeals. Is, did the legislature intend for municipalities to be amongst those group of persons known as appropriate persons in 43901? Second issue is the conclusive presumption found in 43901 a statute of limitation? Is it, on the other hand, a presumed consent? Is it a validating statute? Or that Parker will suggest today that it is simply a rule of law adopted by the legislature in its public policy duties to guide the state in the matters which are discussed? And finally, is Parker required to provide summary judgment proof in this case that it had the fundamental right, power to annex the subject or disputed territory in the first instance? As to issue number one, I think it's clear and undisputed that for Parker to annex the disputed territory in January of 1989, the written consent of Murphy was required as a necessary step in the annexation process.
And you can see that that was not done.
That was not done. It's undisputed. The issue before you today is, though, is whether by operation of law, that is, by operation of 43901, that Murphy's consent is a fact that is conclusively presumed.
Mr. Rapier, were you the city attorney at the time of this annexation?
Yes, I was.
Were you trying to pull the fast one on the city of Murphy, or was it just an error made?
I wasn't present at that meeting. I looked at the ordinance. I generally sign all ordinances as proved as to form. I didn't sign this one. I think it's just a matter of an oversight. These both are small towns, less than 2,000, and they occasionally do not submit their annexation request. This is a request by the owners to their city engineer for to review all things such as ATJ lines. They now do that.
Part of this area is in Parker's ATJ.
Yes.
About okay. Half.
About half, 27 some odd acres in the disputed territory is 14 acres. Long, narrow, as you can see from the record, strip line.
Once this ordinance is adopted, what type of public notice is given? How would Murphy know that some of their property is in?
As the record shows, and of course the chapter 43 in the procedure section, shows that there must be two public hearings. Those public hearings were published in the Plano Star Carrier, which is distributed in Murphy and Parker, the next door neighbors in Collin County. All both of them neighbors of Plano. There
with
is
legal an descriptions of the property?
Yes.
And the record shows those were held?
Those were held. Publication of notices where there's the publisher's affidavit in the record as part of Parker's motion for summary judgment. The public hearings were held. There's then a subsequent time after that that the ordinance was adopted at a meeting that was complied with the Open Records Act. And then the ordinance is subsequently, a certified copy of that ordinance is filed in the deed records of the county, in this case, county.
As a practical matter, how would a city like Murphy keep track of what Parker is up to? Would they have to assign someone to read the papers weekly and check the meets and bounds descriptions to see if someone was invading an ETJ?
Well, they could do that. Most of these towns are very aware of what surveys they're in and what abstracts they're in. They're not that many because they're pretty small. Secondly, there's also, you can see development. I mean, roads being built, water lines being laid, that's evident. It's part of it. And the fire department's doing about it. So the development is clearly there on the land.
What evidence is there in the summary judgment record of the development of the infrastructure by the city of Parker in this annex area?
Well, there's certainly there's the affidavit of Betty McMimmy, and I cannot recall whether she has it in there. I know that's fact is asserted in our motion for summary judgment. Whether or not it's supported by a summary judgment evidence, I can't recall any evidence of the exhibits, if you will, attached to the petitioner's plaintiff's deal. They show certain maps, and among those maps are the platting, the lots where the roofs go, and things of that nature.
Bottom line, how much money has City Park invested in this territory?
I don't know.
None?
Well, no, the city has an investment. There's streets and there's water lines and there's drainage ditches and all these things as part of their tax base, and they've provided those services. But how much investment there is, I do not know.
Whatever there is, if there is no limitation statute, what are Parker's legal options?
What are Parker's legal options?
If there is no limitation statute.
Well, I think in this case, that 14 acres will be back out in the county. And we just, that 14 acres is taken out of the tax base, and that may or may not cause a raise in the ad valorem tax of the balance of the town to service the bond indebtedness, which are general obligation bonds, which have been issued and sold by Parker.
In the meantime, Parker is assessed taxes.
Yes, it has.
On these folks, and if the property is de-annexed, what do they have to show for their tax expenditure?
Well, not much. Some land back out in the county. Both of these cities are general law municipalities. So the only way that Murphy can annex and serve the area is under 43.033, which they have to show they provide the water service and things of this nature. This territory is in Parker's CCN, took up the Parker water system, et cetera, so there would have to be Parker would still be required under the Texas Water Code to provide water. They could charge for that water, and think it's still being, I don't know whose fire district it's in, but police, Parker has a police department, fire department, and water system. The service of that would obviously have to be worked out. I guess the sheriff would have first call. Whoever fire district is has first call on fire trucks. The only way you can get to this property is through Parker. You have to come into Parker and then go down state lane or whatever it is to get to this part of the subdivision now that would be out of the county. Resolution of the problem of what the legislature intended is always kind of vexing. There's analysis that the Court of Appeals uses. It's kind of the plain language analysis you all used in Laidlaw case versus Wilmer. And that was pretty simple in this case. That it, in order for Park to annex it, it had to be, Murphy had to consent under 43, I think it's 43.023. And the Chapter 311 of the Government Code, as we've already discussed, defines persons to be political subdivisions. Political subdivisions include municipalities, Parker's municipality, and that's the end of the case. It's not ambiguous, it's clear, it's plain, it works nicely.
Council claims there was a substantive, if you're right, there has been a substantive change upon codification of this statute, which the legislature disclaimed any intention to do.
I don't think that's necessarily true, because if you look at the history, Your Honor, in 1949, when 974C-4 was adopted, the only persons that could consent to annexation were the inhabitants, and that had been the law in this state since 1875. Inhabitants was subsequently changed to registered voters. That worked better under the election code. But 4 years later, in 1953, in 974G, the legislature decided, well, maybe owners can consent or request annexation. Owners of sparsely populated areas of less than 3 registered voters. Then 10 years later, we have Article 970A, the Municipal Annexation Act, and it creates yet another type of person that a municipality could consent to the reduction of their ETJ in the annexation process. And then in 1987, of course, we had the Local Government Code. And the stated purpose of the codification is to gather these things together, to reorder them, rearrange them, in order to make them supposedly more understandable and more accessible.
What happened to 978A? Where is it recalled?
978A is now Chapter 43 of the Local Government Code.
Which specific?
The whole chapter, just about. 978A is a pretty long, involved piece of legislation, and is essentially contained almost in total, divided up in different parts of Chapter 43. Now the legislature, whether we believe it or not, is presumed to have complete knowledge of all prior legislation. So when we get to 87, we have inhabitants, now registered voters, we have owners, sparsely territorial consent, and we have municipalities. I submit to you that it is a fair and correct construction that they took all these groups and put them into a group known as those persons required in law rather than naming them out, because if you accept the construction of Murphy, you exclude owners. And you also exclude municipalities. So I don't think that we have to see the legislature's knowledge of this stopped in 49. It continued to further develop in this area in 53 and 63 and finally culminated in 87 with the Local Government Code. Issue number 3 is one that after I read all the briefs and of course read the opinions below, getting ready for today, it came to me that this conclusive presumption in 43901, what manner of being is this, or statute? Is it really a statute of limitation? Is it as a implied consent? Is it a validating statute? Or is it something else? I think a practical view that it kind of works like as results, it kind of looks like perhaps all three. However, if you look at Chapter 16 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, the statute doesn't use any standard language there. Where we find it says a person must bring a suit for, and that's in almost every one of those sections coming down to Chapter 16. Say for a certain cause of action, and it's a not later than so many years, 1, 2, 4, etc. None of that's found in 43901. It's not that, what is it? I think that perhaps what we have here is what we've known in law is, at least I remember from law school, was a true presumption, statutory conclusive presumption. Example of penal code. Hot check, bad check. State has to prove the defendant issued the check. It wasn't any good. He got the notice. 10 days later, didn't pay. Conclusive presumption of intent to defraud. Same thing was covered in this court in 1971 in Texas Water Rights Commission versus Wright, in which we had a conclusive presumption of the abandonment or the relinquishment of water rights. And this court talked about, wrote on conclusive presumptions there. What we believe it really is simply a, not law of the case, but is a rule of law that the legislature had the power to enact for its own public policy reasons, in which we, sitting here today, really don't have the business of trying to decide whether those public policy reasons were good or bad.
Why would it do it and not include this problem in the validation statutes?
Interesting question. In the validation statutes, you can have a time that's much more compressed than 2 years. I think the current one this time, you could have a validation statute that would validate an annexation in 68 days. We have this particular one that may have validated this one was something short of a year. At least there's a 2-year statute out here that can go the full 720 days or whatever it is, which is considered at least twice to 3-4 times longer.
So the legislature would leave it out of the validation statute and put it in a general 2-year statute to give the injured, the invaded city, if you will, the full benefit of 2 years.
That's the only reason I can come up with here. So
if this is a 2-year statute, wouldn't that encourage cities to surreptitiously pirate other cities' EJs and hope they didn't find out?
Well, I hope not. I think we can't presume that cities are going to be in bad faith. Most of the cities I know have their plates full. They have all they can do to serve the people they have, especially these general cities, except for one small little area where they're already serving somebody water and all these services. They can't annex by fiat anyway. They have to annex by the request of somebody, either the majority of the voters or the
There
owners.
Was a request here.
Hmm?
There was a request here?
Yes. There is the summary judgment proof has a copy of the petition of the owners of the property to become a part of Parker, Texas. So this rule of law that establishes, what it really does, I think, Your Honor, is it establishes a judicial fact, a means of conclusive presumption. So one who wants to take advantage of that has to establish the prerequisite facts, such as the check case and the penal code. In this case, that's exactly what Parker did. He established that it was an annexation ordinance, that it required the consent of Murphy, stipulated that it was in their ETJ at the time. There was no consent. Established that the lawsuit brought by Parker was done so more than 2 years after the annexation ordinance was adopted. Having established as undisputed those what I call prerequisite facts, then you're entitled to the establishment of the judicial fact by conclusive presumption that consent was given, whether or not it was given or not. Just like the check case, whether the defendant actually intended to defraud anybody was not relevant. The fact is, the prerequisite facts have been proved by the state. The last issue I'd like to address is the argument in Murphy's brief and Good Judge Morris's dissent is that there was another problem with Parker's position, is that Parker did not prove that he had fundamental right to annex this territory in the first instance. For instance, in Murphy's brief it is stated that section 43901 does not address Parker's fundamental lack of statutory power to annex the property located within its own ETJ. Well, I submit to you the whole reason we're here is because that annexation encroached on Murphy's ETJ. If it did not encroach on Murphy's ETJ, then Murphy doesn't have standing to bring any kind of lawsuit. They don't have a cause of action. The only cause of action they've pled in this case and argued is it required our consent. We didn't give that consent. And that statute, 43901, doesn't apply to us.
You still have not answered the question. Under what authority has the city of Parker annexed land that you had no authority to annex? Right. And what gave you the authority to annex land that's outside your extraterritorial jurisdiction? What is that question?
To me, it's just not relevant and not necessary in this case because Murphy does not have standing. We don't have to prove that.
You don't have to prove that you have authority to annex territory outside the ETJ?
Not as vis-a-vis Murphy. If the plaintiff included the landowners, or if the plaintiff included the inhabitants or the voters in the area, I think that would be true.
So you can hypothetically annex land, several counties down, and if they are slipped the wheel in this small county and they don't file a lawsuit within 2 years, somehow, magically, that's part of your territory.
Is that
your argument?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
Well, under the rule of this case, is that not possible?
No, sir. I don't think so.
What keeps it from happening?
Because we have other plaintiffs who can bring that argument.
What have they done?
The state of Texas through a Coronto proceeding.
What have they done?
Well, if they don't, they don't. If this case, to finish the answer, Your Honor, if this case would simply have been that Parker annexed outside of its 1/2 mile ETJ, but did not annex any of Murphy's ETJ, then Murphy does not have standing to complain. That's not part of Parker's burden of proof in this case. And it wasn't part of this lawsuit until we got before this court. It could be, and probably should be, part of another lawsuit with different plaintiffs. But Murphy simply doesn't have the standing to complain about that. And there's no proof in the record whether it was within Parker's ETJ or not.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Yes,
may it please the court. First, I'd like to respond to the standing argument. First time I've heard that, I would assert that probably should have been brought in lower court in its way. It's been brought as a defense. But I believe that obviously Murphy does have standing to challenge any action that affects taking of its property within Murphy's ETJ. We're not complaining about Parker's annexation of land within Parker's ETJ. The argument is that even if the Court of Appeals was right, we don't believe they are, and that somehow section 43.901 is some form of an implied consent. And it can be read to say that Murphy, by not contesting it within 2 years, you consented to give up part of your ETJ. The question is then, does Parker still have the power to annex that territory? Because is it in Parker's ETJ? It would only be in Parker's ETJ if, through other sections of local government code, Parker's ETJ expands to fill that void. There's no summary judgment evidence as to Parker's population or as to whether or not the area within Murphy's ETJ, once relinquished, would constitute part of Parker's ETJ. I believe that's very important.
Why does that make any difference if the statute creates a conclusive presumption of consent and thus a statute of repose saying nobody can challenge it? Why does that make any difference to the
Well, there's two different points of consent. There's a consent to give up ETJ, which the Court of Appeals construed that 43.901 somehow is an alternative to those sections of the local government code that says that consent has to be in writing by ordinance or resolution. And then there's this other consent to consenting to the annexation. The point I'm trying to make is there is no consent to an annexation. There's nothing in the local government code or the Municipal Annexation Act that says that a city, like Murphy, says, Parker, we consent to your annexation. What we have to do is, if you want to annex something in our ETJ, we have to first give up that ETJ. And the local government code in section 42 makes it very clear that that consent has to be in writing by ordinance or resolution. And I believe that's real important because there's a political accountability that's involved there. It's obvious, at least to me, that the legislature, by requiring the governmental entity at a regularly convened council meeting, which is the only way they can pass their ordinance and resolution, subject to all the protections of open meetings and all the protections of the public is afforded, that is the only way a city can relinquish part of its extraterritorial jurisdiction, by express writing. The legislature made one exception to that, and it's contained within the text of section 42.023, and that says, except in situations of overlapping jurisdiction, under the judicial apportionment cases. That's the one exception the legislature has already expressly put in the statute that says you don't have to have written consent.
If Parker has not annexed this property, will or can Murphy annex it?
They can. Will they annex it? I cannot. I know that, I mean, I can't bind them. I know there have been discussions that they are interested in that property. They would not be bringing a lawsuit if they were not interested in that property. Also, to go back to the question that you raised earlier in terms of services, if we choose to annex it, the government code also provides in section 43.056 does require that we would provide services, a service plan out to that area. The local government code envisions that you can't annex property without bringing them appropriate services. So they're not going to be left out in limbo if they're annexed.
Could Murphy annex this piece of property without the owners of the property, some of the owners petitioning Murphy?
I believe now due to recent changes in the legislature, well, we would have to provide either water or sewer. Currently, that water and sewer is coming from Parker. So I believe unless we provided water or sewer, we could not unilaterally annex it. It would probably take a petition at this point from those that neighborhood to come into the city of Murphy. Whether they desire to do that, I have no idea. That has not been something that we've looked at.
Some of the people say, we don't want to be part of Murphy. We want to stay where we are, city of Parker.
Well, if that is their will, and it's they're not within Parker's ETJ, they will probably be in a different situation, and obviously be something that has to be worked out between the communities. But just in closing, I would say that based on the historical history of the articles, the case law, which says that annexation to other ETJs is void, that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals simply misconstrued this statute on a statutory construction basis, we ask that the Court of Appeals and the trial court's decision be reversed. Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
Yeah.